I said I'm not working. Oh, God, get out. Can't you see I'm upset?
He broke down in tears, clutching at his face, and I stood by the door, suddenly noticing that it felt very warm in the room. I watched the boy for a few minutes, and then something occurred to me. You knew Gloria. The boy sniffed and wiped carefully at his eyes.
Yes, I knew her. Oh, my face. Please go away.
No, you don't understand. I'm trying to find out who killed him. Her. The boy looked up at me plaintively.
Are you a cop?
No, a reporter.
A reporter? Well, I've got a hell of a story for you. Whoever it was that they found down on that bridge, it couldn't have been Gloria.
Wasn't Gloria? The rising temperature in the room was making me thirsty, and I took another big swig of beer. What makes you think so?
Because Gloria never left this room.
Never? It occurred to me that I'd been up too long and had too much to drink. I was having trouble following the kid.
What do you mean? That night I was in the hallway outside my room with a customer. I saw Gloria come in here, alone. I was out there for a good hour and a half, and her door never opened. I figured she was asleep. And then one of the girls comes screaming in, saying that a cop just told her they found Gloria dead downtown. I ran right in here, and sure enough, she was gone, but she never left.
I tried to figure it out. Well, the window, then. As I crossed to it, I stumbled a bit. I really did need some sleep. The window groaned as I opened it, and when I put my head out, the air wasn't as cold as it should have been. The boy was speaking behind me.
The window? How? Did she fly? It's a straight drop down, and Gloria didn't have a ladder or rope or anything. Besides, I asked one of the girls working the front of the alley if she saw Gloria come out that way. She said no.
The drop from the window to the alley was indeed a precipitous one. As for the roof, it was another two stories up, along a brick wall that offered no apparent purchases, and it was without a fire escape of any kind. I came back inside and closed the window.
Then...
Suddenly I collapsed onto the bed. The boy let out one little shriek at that, and then another when he looked to the door. Following his glance, I saw Ellison, Razor Riley, and a couple of their favorites in the doorway. Riley had his trademark out and was wiping it back and forth across the palm of one hand. Despite the condition of my mind, I knew instantly they'd slipped chloral into my beer. A lot of chloral.
I told you not to talk to anybody more.
Well, girls, he's a pretty one to look at, ain't he? Who wants to have some fun with the reporter?
Two of the young painted men leapt onto the bed and began to tug at my clothes. I was able to get halfway up and onto my elbow before Riley raced over and laid a shot on my jaw. Then the two youths were fighting over my billfold and tearing at my pants as Riley began to bind my hands. Unconsciousness was coming fast, but just before it arrived, I thought I caught a glimpse of Stevie Taggart jumping into the room like a wild wolf cub, brandishing a long piece of wood studded with rusty nails. The drug-induced dream that followed was peopled by bizarre creatures, half-human and half-animal, that flew, climbed, and slithered down the sides of a high stone wall while I watched in despair, unable to get to the ground. At one point, the primeval landscape around the wall was shaken by an earthquake that seemed to speak with Kreitzler's voice, after which the creatures in my dream became more numerous, and my need to get to the ground more desperate. Consciousness, when it finally came, brought little relief, for I had no idea where I was. My head felt remarkably clear, from which I took it that I'd been asleep for many hours, but the airy, expansive room around me was completely strange. Spottily furnished with a combination of clerical desks and elegant Italian appointments, it seemed a nonsensical chamber, well suited to another dream. Arched windows in the style of the Gothic Revival ringed the space and gave it the feel of a monastery, but the spacious dimensions were more like those of a Broadway sweatshop. Anxious to inspect the place more closely, I tried to get up, but fell back in a slight swoon, and since there seemed to be no one about to call to for assistance, I was forced to content myself with studying my strange surroundings while flat on my back. On one long, inlaid mahogany dining table stood a silver candelabra, next to which was a Remington typewriter. This incongruity was echoed in the room's wall hangings. Across from my divan, an ostentatiously framed oil view of Florence hung next to an enormous map of Manhattan that was encrusted with several pins. The pins bore small red flags. On the opposite wall was a large chalkboard, notably blank. It wasn't any sane person's living quarters, and it certainly wasn't an office. Hallucination, I began to think. But then I looked out the window directly in front of me and saw two familiar sights. The top of McCreary's department store, with its elegant mansard roof and cast-iron arched windows, and to the left, a similar top section of the St. Denis Hotel. The two institutions I knew occupied opposite corners of 11th Street, on the west side of Broadway. Suddenly, a loud bell tolled. I spun to my left as fast as my condition would allow, and out another arched window I saw what I knew to be the spire of Grace Church on 10th Street. It seemed close enough to touch. Then from out of the shadows came Sarah, dressed in a simple navy dress that did not encumber her movements. She carried a tray, on which sat a steaming bowl. "Try some broth and bread, John. It'll give you strength."
"Sarah, where are we?"
"We're home, John. At least it'll have to pass for home for as long as this investigation takes. It's our headquarters." I could see that she very much enjoyed the word. "Speaking of which, I've got to get back to Mulberry Street and report to Theodore. The telephone line has been installed, and he's been anxious about that." She turned toward the back of the room. "Cyrus, can you come out and help Mr. Moore?" Cyrus soon joined us, the sleeves of his blue and white striped shirt rolled up and a pair of suspenders strapped over his broad chest.
"But Sarah, you haven't told me. Cyrus knows everything."
She grabbed a simple coat from an elaborately detailed oak stand that stood by the door. "And I'm late. Finish the broth, John." She disappeared out the door. Cyrus pulled up a delicate straight-back chair with silver and green upholstery.
"You're looking much better, sir." "I'm alive, and even more remarkably, I'm in New York. I was sure I'd wake up in South America or on a privateering ship. Oh, tell me, Cyrus, my last memory is of Stevie. Did he—" "Yes, sir. Confidentially, he's had his share of trouble sleeping since he saw the body on the bridge. He was out roaming the neighborhood that night when he saw you walking down Broadway. He said you looked kind of unsteady on your feet, sir. So he followed you, just to be sure you'd be all right. When he saw you go into Paris's hall, he figured he'd wait outside, understandably. But then a policeman caught sight of him and accused him of the usual activity for that spot. Stevie denied it and told the cop he was waiting for you. The officer didn't believe him, and so Stevie bolted into the hall. He wasn't trying to rescue you, he was just trying to escape. But the way things worked out, the one was the other. The cop didn't arrest anybody, of course, but he made sure you got out with your skin."
"I see. And how did I get to—"
"Say, where the hell are we, Cyrus?"
"Number 808 Broadway, Mr. Moore. The top floor, which would be the sixth. The doctor engaged it as a base of operations for the investigation, not so close to Mulberry Street, as will be noticed, but a carriage can have you there in just a few minutes."
"And what about all these furnishings, or whatever they are?"
"The doctor and Miss Howard went looking for furniture yesterday over in Brooklyn, and an office supplier's, but the doctor said he couldn't live with that sort of stuff for a day, much less an extended period of time. So they bought just the desks, and then went to an auction on Fifth Avenue. The furniture of the Marchese Luigi Carcano of Italy was being sold off. They bought quite a bit of it. As soon as we had most of it in, the doctor figured he'd move you from his house to here. Said we couldn't waste any more time nursing you. He gave you a little more chloral so you'd come out of it easy. Wanted you ready for work when you woke up." And by late afternoon, I was. At 5 o'clock sharp, each of us, Laszlo, Sarah, the Isaacsons, and me, sat at one of the five desks, from which vantage points we could clearly see and discuss matters with one another. There was nervous but pleasant chatter as we settled in,
and real camaraderie when we began to discuss the events of our various days. As the evening sun dipped above the Hudson, sending rich golden light over the rooftops of western Manhattan and through our Gothic front windows, I realized that we'd become, with remarkable speed, a working unit. We reviewed what we had learned so far, and Kreitzler noted each fact and theory on the large chalkboard where, he said, we would create our imaginary man. When we finished, it seemed that there were precious few white marks on that enormous black space, and at least some of the few, he warned, would not remain. The use of chalk, he said, was an indication of how many mistakes he expected himself and the rest of us to make along the way. We were in uncharted country, and must not become discouraged by setbacks and difficulties, or by the amount of material we would have to master along the way, he explained. The rest of us were a little confused by that statement. Kreitzler then produced four separate but identical piles of books and papers. Articles by Laszlo's friend Adolf Meyer and other alienists, the works of philosophers and evolutionists from Hume and Locke to Spencer and Schopenhauer, monographs by the elder Forbes Winslow, whose theories had originally inspired Kreitzler's theory of context, and finally, in all its weighty two-volume splendor, William James's The Principles of Psychology. These and more were dropped on our desks, producing loud, ponderous booms. The Isaacsons, Sarah and I, all exchanged worried glances, looking and feeling like beleaguered students on the first day of class, which, obviously, is just what we were. Kreitzler spelled out the purpose of our going through such an ordeal. From that moment on, he said, we must make every possible effort to rid ourselves of preconceptions about human behavior. We must try not to see the world through our own eyes, nor to judge it by our own values, but through and by those of our killer. His experience, the context of his life, was all that mattered. Any aspect of his behavior that puzzled us, from the most trivial to the most horrendous, we must try to explain by postulating childhood events that could lead to such eventualities. This process of cause and effect, what we would soon learn was called psychological determinism, might not always seem entirely logical to us, but it would be consistent. Kreitzler emphasized that no good would come of conceiving this person as a monster, because he was most assuredly a man, or a woman, and that man or woman had once been a child. First and foremost, we must get to know that child, and to know his parents, his siblings, his complete world. It was pointless to talk about evil and barbarity and madness. None of these concepts would lead us any closer to him. But if we could capture the human child in our imaginations, then we could capture the man, in fact. And if that is not reward enough, Kreitzler glanced from one of our gaping faces to another, there is always food. Food, we learned during the next few weeks, was quite a major reason why Laszlo had selected number 808 Broadway. We were within easy walking distance of some of Manhattan's best restaurants. All these centers of culinary brilliance became our informal conference rooms during legions of lunches and dinners, although there were many occasions when the grim work with which we were preoccupied made it difficult indeed to concentrate on gustatory satisfaction. Then, at 1:45 a.m. on a Saturday, when I was in the midst of a deep sleep at my grandmother's house, the telephone rang. It was Sarah. Her voice tinged with anxiety. John, it's happened. Where? Castle Garden, the Battery. The Isaacsons are getting their camera and other equipment ready. They have to arrive before the rest of us, so that the officers who were first on the scene can be dismissed. Theodore's there now, making sure it goes smoothly. I've already called Dr. Kreitzler.
Right.
John?
Yes?
I'm the only one who's never... How bad will it be?
What could I say? There were only practicalities to consider.
You'll want ammonia salts, but try not to worry too much. We'll all be there. Pick me up in a cab. We'll go together. I heard her breathe deeply once. All right, John.
Castle Garden sits in the heart of Battery Park, and to get to it, we had to travel to the base of Broadway and beyond. That meant a fast trip through the pastiche of architectural styles that made up the publishing and financial districts of Manhattan in those days. The longer one was exposed to the neighborhood, the more one detected a common quality among all these buildings that overrode any stylistic variance. wealth. I had spent much of my childhood in this part of Manhattan. My father ran a moderately sized investment house, and from an early age I'd been struck by the fantastic activity that surrounded the getting and keeping of money. This activity could be alternately seductive and repellent, but by 1896 it was arguably New York's strongest reason for being. I felt this undercurrent of enormous power again that night, even though the district was dark and dormant at 2:30 in the morning. And as we passed the graveyard at Trinity Church, where the father of the American economic system, Alexander Hamilton, lay buried, I found myself smiling bemusedly and thinking, he's audacious, all right. Whoever our quarry was, and whatever the personal turmoil that was propelling him, he was no longer confining his activities to the less respectable parts of town. He had ventured into the preserve of the wealthy elite and dared to leave a body in Battery Park, within easy sight of the offices of many of the city's most influential financial elders. Yes, if our man was in fact sane, as Kreitzler so passionately believed, then this latest act was not only barbarous but audacious, in that peculiar way that has always produced a mixture of horror and grudging acknowledgement in natives of this city. Our hansom released us at Bowling Green, and we crossed over to enter the park. Inside, a very few arc lights directed us along a straight path toward the prodigious stone walls of Castle Garden. Formerly a heavily armed fort called Castle Clinton, the structure had been built to guard New York during the War of 1812, after which it was turned over to the city. We climbed an old staircase in one wall of the fort. A decagonal turret with two windows in each face stood at the center of the roof, which offered a commanding view of New York Harbor and Bartholdi's still new Statue of Lady Liberty out on Bedloe's Island. Near the edge of the roof, closest to the waterfront, were Roosevelt, Kreitzler, and Lucius and Marcus Isaacson. Next to them stood a large, boxy camera on a wooden tripod, and lying in front of the camera, bathed in the light of another work lamp, was the cause of our coming together. The blood was visible, even from a distance. Lucius's attention was fixed on the body, but Kreitzler and Roosevelt were facing away and talking very heatedly. When Kreitzler saw us emerge from the staircase, he came directly over, Roosevelt following behind and shaking his head. Marcus moved to the camera as Laszlo addressed Sarah and me.
Based on the condition of the body, there would seem to be little doubt. It's our man's work.
A roundsman from the 27th Precinct was first on the scene. He says he can remember seeing the boy regularly at the Golden Rule, though he doesn't recall his name.
The Golden Rule Pleasure Club was a disorderly house on West 4th Street that specialized in boy whores. Kreitzler put his hands on Sarah's shoulders.
It's not an easy sight, Sarah.
I didn't expect it to be.
She breathed deeply and moved toward the body. Kreitzler began to speak to me, but I put him off for a moment and trailed a few steps behind Sarah as she moved toward the glowing hemisphere of electric light in the corner of the rooftop. The body was that of an olive-skinned boy, with delicate Semitic features and thick black hair on the right side of his head. On the left side, a large section of scalp had been torn away, revealing the slick surface of the skull. Other than that, the mutilation seemed to be identical to those that had marked Giorgio Santarelli, except that the injuries to the buttocks had not been repeated. The eyes were missing, the genitals had been cut off and stuffed in the mouth, the torso was crisscrossed by deep lacerations, the wrists were bound, and the right hand had been severed and apparently removed from the scene. As Kreitzler said, there seemed little doubt about who was responsible. It was all as distinctive as a signature. I headed back to Kreitzler and Roosevelt. As we reviewed the scene, we realized it would take a cool mind to plan this kind of violence so precisely and then carry it out so thoroughly, knowing the possibility of apprehension was never very far off. This cool head for carefully planned violence suggested a martial spirit. A military background of some kind was definitely indicated. Then the doctor slapped a newspaper on my chest.
Your friend Lincoln Steffens has written quite an article for the morning edition of the Post, John. How could anyone be so stupid?
Prominently displayed on the Post's front page was an article announcing that the Zweig killings and the Santarelli murder were now believed by high police officials to be the work of the same man. It was now clear, Steffens declared in his best rabble-rousing style, that no children are safe.
There were other sensational details as well. Santorelli, it was stated, had been assaulted, the euphemism for rape, before his death, although in fact Kreitzler had found no evidence of sexual violation. Steffens went on to write that in some quarters of the city, the murders were being talked of as the work of a supernatural creature, though the infamous Ellison and his cohorts made far more promising suspects. I folded the paper and tapped it slowly against my leg. This is very bad. Even if every other person in the city fails to pay attention, there is one who will see it, and I truly fear his reaction. Just then we noticed at the edges of Battery Park, near the several points of entry, crowds were gathering. Not the kind of well-dressed, politely behaved throngs that occupied the area during the day, but milling pockets of shabbily dressed men and women on whom the mark of poverty was plain, even from a distance. Some carried torches and several were accompanied by children, who seemed to be thoroughly enjoying this unusual early morning foray. As yet, there were no overt signs of threat, but it had all the makings of a mob. Sarah came and stood by me.
John, who are they?
Offhand, I'd say that the morning edition of the Post has reached the streets. It now became clear that there were still more people streaming into the area from surrounding streets. The mob would soon number in the many hundreds. Someone had done an expert job of inflammation. Roosevelt was indignant.
This is a crime scene. I will not have it disturbed by any mob, whatever their complaint.
He glanced about the roof, then picked up a stout section of cut wood.
Doctor, none of you can be found here. Take Miss Howard and go. The Isaacsons and I will face these people at the front gate.
As we hurried away through the park, I got a brief but clear glimpse of an expensive brougham that was parked at a corner which enjoyed a full view of the events at the fort. A hand, well manicured with a tasteful silver ring on the little finger, appeared at the brougham's door, followed by the upper part of a man's body. Even in the dim light of the arc lamps, I could see the gleam of an elegant tie stud, and soon a set of handsome black Irish features. Paul Kelly. The crowd, then, had been Kelly's work, probably in response to Stephen's remarks about Biff Ellison and the Post. It all fit. Kelly was not known for making idle threats, and whipping up a fury over the murders among a deeply and perpetually disgruntled segment of the populace would have been child's play for so devious a man. Pulling Kreitzler along with me, I hurried over to the elegant black brougham. Eat-em-up Jack McManus was hanging onto the side of the vehicle, swinging the gargantuan right arm that had made him a formidable force in the prize ring for nearly a decade before he'd quit the fight game to work as a bouncer for Kelly. When he spotted us, Kelly was full of glee.
"Will you look at them? The pigs have actually gotten off their knees for once. This ought to make for a few sleepless nights on Mansion Mile, eh? It won't last, of course. They'll be back to packing their kids into sweatshops for $1 a week before the boy's even been boxed. But for now, it does make a glorious picture."
Kelly extended his heavily ringed right hand to Kreitzler.
"How do you do, Doctor? It's a genuine privilege."
Laszlo took the hand very tentatively.
"Mr. Kelly? At least someone finds this situation amusing." "Oh, I do, Doctor, I do. That's why I arranged it."
"Why concern yourself with the matter at all?"
"Because it riles me."
For the first time, Kelly's face went straight.
"That's right, Doctor. It riles me. Those pigs back there get fed all that slop about society by the boys on Fifth Avenue just as soon as they're off the boat. And what do? They knock themselves out trying to eat every bit of it. It's a sucker bet, a crooked game, whatever you want to call it. And there's a part of me that just wouldn't mind seeing it go the other way for a little while."
His amiable grin suddenly returned.
"Or maybe there are deeper reasons for my attitude, Doctor. Maybe you could find something in the context of my life that would explain it, if you had access to that kind of information."
The remark surprised me considerably, and I could see that Kreitzler, too, hadn't expected it. There was something very intimidating about Kelly's rough-hewn intellectual agility, a sense that here was a man who could pose a serious threat on any number of levels. But whatever the reasons, I'm enjoying this entire affair immensely. Later that day, I met Marcus Isaacson, and we marched across town to the Golden Rule Pleasure Club. As we went, Marcus explained a theory he had formulated. The notion of our killers being an experienced mountain and rock climber had first occurred to him when I brought the boy's story back from Parisa's Hall. Then at Castle Garden, Marcus had discovered distinctive rope fibers along the rear edge of the rooftop. In the grass below, he'd found a rather innocuous steel spike, which he now pulled out of his coat pocket. The thing had an eye at one end for securing ropes, Marcus told me. It was a piton. For the remainder of our walk, Marcus went on to explain the larger implications of his discovery. Though mountaineering hadn't really caught on as a form of recreation in North America as of 1896, in England, Switzerland, and Germany, it had become very popular. Given that our killer displayed what could only be called expertise, it was likely that he'd been exposed to the sport quite a long time ago, perhaps even in his youth. And it was therefore very possible that his family had emigrated to America from one of those three European nations in the not-too-distant past. That might not mean much just at the moment, but it was easy to see that when added to other crucial factors further down the road, it could become highly illuminating. In such knowledge, there was real cause for hope. We would need an abundant reservoir of that particular emotion during our visit to the Golden Rule Pleasure Club, a pestilential little hole run by a large, repulsive woman called Scotch Anne. When we entered the nondescript front door, we came face to face with a round-bellied, middle-aged man in expensive evening clothes, who shielded his face as he exited the place and then hurried into a very expensive carriage that was waiting for him at the curb. Behind him came a boy of 15 or 16, typically dolled up for a night's work and counting money with great satisfaction. The boy murdered on the Castle Garden roof was named Ali ibn Ghazi, although here at the Golden Rule he was called Fatima. As soon as the back room he had regularly used had been vacated by a furtive pair of men and an exhausted-looking boy, we entered, braving the warm, humid atmosphere and the smell of sweat, in order to check Marcus's theory about the killer's method of movement. We found what we were looking for, a filthy window that could be opened, above which were four stories of sheer, unencumbered brick wall leading to the roof of the building. We would need to get a look at that roof before the sun set fully. Nevertheless, as we left the little chamber, I paused long enough to ask one momentarily idle boy in a neighboring room what time Ali had left the Golden Rule on the night of his death. The young man frowned and struggled with the question a bit.
"Damn me. That's peculiar, ain't it? Now that you mention it, I don't remember ever seeing him go."
The same question, put a few more times to various painted faces as we walked out of the club, brought similar answers. Ali's departure, then, had almost certainly been effected through the window in his room, and then up the rear wall of the building. Marcus and I ran outside, up to the first floor entrance and the small vestibule, then into a vermin-infested staircase that wound up to a pitch-black doorway, splattered with tar, that opened onto the roof. Our quick movements were inspired by more than the dying sunlight. We both knew that we were tracing our killer's steps more precisely than we'd been able to do before, and the effect was both chilling and exhilarating. The roof was like any other in New York, spotted with chimneys, bird droppings, ramshackle utility sheds, and the odd bottle or cigarette end. Because it was early in the spring and still chilly, there were none of the signs of regular habitation, chairs, tables, hammocks, that would appear during the summer months. Like a hunting dog, Marcus strode directly to the back of the slightly sloped rooftop, and with no thought to the height, peered over and into the alley. Then he removed his coat, spread it below him, and lay down on his stomach so that his head hung out over the edge of the building. A broad smile came to his face within moments. He picked something that was invisible to me out of one of the many patches of tar.
Rope fibers! He must have anchored the rope to that chimney.
Following Marcus's pointing finger, I glanced at a squat brick structure toward the front of the roof.
"That's a lot of rope, John, plus the other pieces of equipment. He'd need a bag of some kind to carry it all in. We ought to mention that when we're asking around."
I studied the monotonous expanse of the other roofs on the block.
"We probably wouldn't have come up through this building staircase. He's smarter than that."
Marcus got to his feet, pocketed some of the rope fibers, and picked up his coat. And he's familiar with getting around on rooftops. I think we can be pretty sure now that he spent a lot of time on them. So it wouldn't be tricky for him to size up every building on the block, find the one with the least activity, and use its staircase. Or ignore the staircases altogether. Remember, it's late at night. He could scale the walls without anybody seeing him. Looking to the west, I saw that the reflective expanse of the Hudson River was quickly turning from bright red to black. I turned fully around twice in the near darkness, seeing the entire area in a new way. Control, Marcus. Yes, this is his world up here. Whatever mental turmoil Dr. Kreitzler sees in the bodies, this is very different. On these rooftops, he's acting with complete confidence. I sighed and shook as a river breeze hit us. The confidence of the devil himself. Just then a voice came from somewhere back by the door to the stairs.
Not the devil, sir. A saint.
Marcus moved toward the voice cautiously. Who's there? Come out or I'll have you up for interfering with police business. And then one of the painted youths from the Golden Rule, one I didn't recall having seen downstairs, stepped out from behind the stairway door. The makeup on his face was badly smudged, and he had a blanket pulled around his shoulders.
No, please, I only want to help.
His brown eyes blinked nervously. With a sinking feeling, I realized that he could not have been more than 10 years old. Taking hold of Marcus's arm and pulling him back, I urged the boy forward.
That's all right. We know you do. Just come out into the open.
Even in the increasingly dim light of the rooftop, I could see that the boy's face, as well as the blanket he was huddled in, were smudged with soot and tar. Have you been here all night? The boy nodded.
Ever since they told us.
He was starting to weep.
This wasn't supposed to happen.
What wasn't? The murder? At the mention of the word, the boy clamped his small hands over his ears and shook his head insistently.
He was supposed to be good. Fatima said so. Everything was supposed to turn out all right.
I went over, put an arm around the boy, and guided him to a low wall that separated the roof where we were from that of the building next door. It's all right. Nothing more is going to happen.
But he could come back.
Who?
Him. Fatima's saint. The one that was supposed to take him away.
Marcus and I glanced at each other quickly. Look, suppose you start by telling me your name.
Well, downstairs they...
Just forget what they call you downstairs for a minute. I rocked his shoulders a bit with my arm. You just tell me what name you were born with. The boy paused, his big eyes taking our measure warily. I must admit, the situation was quite confusing for me, too. All I could think to do was pull out a handkerchief and begin wiping the paint from the boy's face. It did the trick.
My name's Joseph.
Well, Joseph, my name's Moore, and this man is Detective Sergeant Isaacson. Now, suppose you come clean about this saint.
Fatima had been saying for, I guess, about 2 weeks that she'd found a saint. Not like a patron saint in church, not like that. Just a person who was kind and was going to take her away from Scotch Ann to live with him.
And this saint, this is very important, Joseph. Did you ever see him?
No, sir.
Marcus stepped forward. Did Fatima ever meet a man on the roof? Or did you ever notice someone carrying a large bag of some kind?
No, sir.
Joseph brightened, trying to please us. The man came in more than once after Fatima met him, though. I do know that. But he told her never to say who he was. Marcus smiled just a bit. A customer, then. And you never guessed which one it was?
No, sir. Fatima said that if I kept it all secret and was good, then maybe the man would take me away too someday.
I put my arm back around his shoulders tightly, looking out over the rooftops once more. You must hope that doesn't ever happen, Joseph. His brown eyes began to shed tears again. I knelt down. I felt I ought to ask him if he wanted to leave Scotchan's employ. He seemed entirely too young for such business, even by disorderly house standards, and I thought there was a good chance that I could get Kreitzler to take him on as a charity case at the Institute. But Joseph, orphaned since age 3, told me that he'd already had his fill of institutes, orphanages, and foster homes, not to mention alleyways and empty railroad cars. Nothing I said about Kreitzler's place being different had any effect on him. His decision was unappealable. In 1896, children were seen as miniature adults, and according to the law, if they wanted to abandon their lives to vice, that was their business, and their lookout. And so there seemed to be nothing for me to do but say goodbye to that frightened little 10-year-old, and wonder if he wouldn't be the next boy to cross paths with the butcher who was haunting such disreputable houses as the Golden Rule. But just then, an idea occurred to me, one that I thought might help keep Joseph safe and advance our investigation. Joseph, do you have many friends who work in other places like this? He put a finger to his mouth pensively.
Let's see. I guess I do know some. Why?
I want you to tell them what I'm going to tell you. The man who killed Fatima has killed other children who do this kind of work. Mostly boys, though maybe not only boys. I want you to tell your friends that from now on, they've got to be very, very careful about their customers. And most important of all, don't go anywhere with anyone. Never leave the club, no matter how nice the man seems or how much money he offers you. The same goes for your friends. All right?
Well, okay, Mr. Moore, but maybe you and Detective Sergeant Isaacson can come back and check on us sometime. Those other cops, the ones that were here this morning, they didn't seem to care much. They just told everybody to keep quiet about Fatima.
We'll try to do that. I took a pen and a piece of paper from my coat pocket. And if you ever have anything you want to tell someone, anything at all that you think is important, you telephone this number or come straight to this address during the day and to this one at night. I gave him not only our headquarters location and phone number, but also the number of my grandmother's house on Washington Square, wondering for an instant what the old girl would make of this boy if he ever did show up. Don't go to any other cops, Joseph. Tell us everything first. And don't tell any other cops that we were here.
Oh, don't worry. You're the first two cops I ever met that I'd talked to anyway.
That's probably because I'm not a cop. I smiled, and the grin was returned.
He didn't seem like one.
Then Joseph's brows knotted up with another question.
So, why are you trying to find out who killed Fatima?
I put a hand on the boy's head. Because we want to stop him. But the next weeks brought little progress. And then an incident occurred that presented my teammates and me with a new kind of horror, one born not of blood but of words, one that in its own way was as terrible as anything we'd yet encountered. On a particularly pleasant Thursday evening, Kreitzler, Lucius Isaacson, and I were gathered for a drink at Brubacher's Wine Garden on Union Square to compare notes on the day's activities. Suddenly we looked up to find ourselves face to face with Marcus and Sarah. Marcus, wild-eyed and agitated, Sarah, pallid and stunned. I realized that something extraordinary had occurred. They sat down and Sarah very slowly drew an envelope out of her bag. This arrived at the Santarelli's flat yesterday. Mrs. Santarelli brought it to police headquarters this morning. She couldn't read it and was asking for help. No one would give her any, but she refused to go home. Eventually, I found her sitting out by the front steps. I translated it. At least, I translated most of it. She shoved the note into Laszlo's hand. She didn't want to keep it, and since there's nothing anyone at headquarters can do with it, Theodore asked me to bring it along and see what you make of it, Doctor. I watched anxiously as Kreitzler opened the envelope. When Laszlo had glanced over its contents, he drew in breath quickly, though quietly, and nodded his head as though he'd been expecting something like this. Then, without any introduction, Kreitzler read aloud the following.
My dear Mrs. Santorelli, I don't know as it is you what is the source of the vile lies I read in the newspapers, or if the police are behind it and the reporters are part of their scheme, but as I figure it might be you, I take this occasion to straighten you out. In some parts of this world, such as where dirty immigrants like yourself come from, it is often found that human flesh is eaten regular, as other food is so scarce and people would starve without it. I have personally read this and know it to be true. Of course, it is usually children what is eaten, as they are tenderest and best tasting, especially the ass of a small child. Then these people that eat it come here to America and shit their little children shit all round, which is dirty, dirtier than a red engine. On February 18th, I seen your boy parading himself with ashes and paint on his face. I decided to wait and saw him several times before one night I took him away from that place. Saucy boy. I already knew I must eat him. So we went straight to the bridge, and I trussed him up and did him quick. I collected his eyes and took his ass, and it fed me for a week, roasted with onions and carrots. But I never fucked him, though I could have, and he would have liked me too. He died unsoiled by me, and the papers ought to say so. Kreitzler sat back and stared at the note on the table. There is no closing and no signature, understandably. Lucius picked up the note and scanned it. It's him, all right. That business about the buttocks, that was never reported in any of the papers. He put the letter down, and Kreitzler tapped it with one finger. Well, it appears that opportunity has placed a treasure trove into our hands. This note shows that his desperation has reached a new height. He may, in fact, be entering a terminal phase of self-destructive emotions. What? Excuse me, Kreitzler, but what? My heart was beating fast, and my voice trembled as I strained to keep it low. You're still going to insist that he's sane? That he wants us to catch him? He's eating his victims, for God's sake. He may or may not be eating parts of his victims, John. What he most certainly is doing is telling us that he is eating them, knowing that such a statement can only shock us and cause us to work all the harder to find him. That is a sane action. If he were mad, he'd kill, cook the flesh, eat it, and God knows what else, without ever telling anyone. At least not anyone he knew would go directly to the authorities. Just think what he's given us. A vast amount of information to be interpreted. I suggest we make use of it immediately. Marcus, you studied handwriting analysis. Enlighten us. Marcus studied the letter. The man, and the attack of the pen in this case is undoubtedly masculine, who wrote this note had at least several years of schooling that entailed penmanship. This schooling occurred in the United States no more recently than 15 years ago. I could not help a befuddled look, to which Marcus explained. There are clear signs that he was trained, hard and regularly, in the Palmer system of penmanship. Now, the Palmer system was introduced in 1880 and was quickly taken up by schools all over the country. It remained what you might call dominant until just last year, when it began to be replaced in the East and in some big Western cities by the Zahner-Blosser method. Assuming that our killer's primary education ended at no later than age 15... he can't now be any older than 31. It seemed a sound line of reasoning, and with small scratching sounds, Kreitzler put these points on his pad, to be transferred later to the big chalkboard at number 808 Broadway. All right, then. If we assume that our man's about 30 now, and that he finished school at 15 or younger, then he's had another 15 years to evolve both his writing and his personality. It doesn't look like that's been a particularly pleasant time. To begin with, he's an inveterate liar and schemer. I mean, he actually knows his grammar and his spelling,
but he's gone pretty far out of his way to try to make us think that he doesn't. See, he, up here, at the top of the note, he's misspelled straighten, along with figure and occasion. He's had the idea that maybe he can get us to believe that he's ignorant, but he's slipped up. At the bottom, he writes that after he snatched Giorgio, he took him straight to the bridge, and he has no trouble spelling it.
Well, one can only assume that by the end of the letter he's concerned with making his point, rather than with playing games.
Exactly, Doctor. So, his writing is extremely natural. The fact that the misspellings are intentional is also indicated by his script. The false passages are much more hesitating and less certain. The T's, in particular, lack the hard, slashing definition that you have in the rest of the writing. His grammar reveals the same point. In some spots, he tries to mimic the talk of an uneducated farmhand. I seen your boy. But then he can let off a sentence like, he died unsoiled by me, and the papers ought to say so. It's completely inconsistent. But assuming he checked back over the thing after writing it, he failed to spot the inconsistency. That indicates that while he's unquestionably a capable planner, he may have an exaggerated opinion of his own cleverness.
Which leaves us with the considerable task of interpreting the contents.
Kreitzler pulled out his watch and checked the time. Nearly 9. It might be better if our minds were fresh, but we all knew what the but was. Our killer wasn't factoring rest periods for his pursuers into his schedule. With that pressing thought in mind, we got up to depart for number 808 Broadway, where coffee would be brewed. Whatever engagements any of us had been foolish enough to make for later in the evening were implicitly cancelled. The moment we came into our headquarters that night and began to settle ourselves at our desks, Kreitzler resumed.
Now, the salutation. Why, my dear Mrs. Santorelli?
Lucius jumped in. It's overly affectionate and informal. He knows his letter is going to devastate the woman, and he's enjoying it. He's playing with her, sadistically.
Agreed.
Kreitzler underlined the word sadism, which was already written on the board. And I'd like to point out, Doctor, that this further demonstrates the nature of his hunting. Lucius had lately become firmly convinced that our killer's apparent anatomical knowledge arose from his being an accomplished hunter, because of the stalking nature of many of his activities. The toying confirms something beyond even blood-crazed hunting. It's a sporting mentality.
Laszlo waited. Your argument is sound, Detective Sergeant, but I'll need a bit more convincing given the prerequisite and its implications.
The prerequisite for a killer's being a sportsman, put simply, was a certain amount of leisure time in his youth, when he could have engaged in hunting not only for survival but for pleasure as well. This, in turn, implied either that he had an upper-class urban background, the upper being the only real leisure class in the city in those days before child labor laws, when even middle-class parents tended to work their offspring long hours, or that he had been brought up in a rural area. Each assumption would have narrowed our search significantly, and Laszlo needed to be completely certain of our reasoning before he would accept either of them.
As for his opening statement, there's the pronounced emphasis on lies,
Sarah extrapolated from this.
You get the feeling he's all too familiar with dishonesty and hypocrisy. And yet he is still outraged by them. Any theories?
I shrugged. Well, he might himself have been accused of it, unjustly in all likelihood, perhaps frequently. Kreitzler chalked the word dishonesty, and then beneath it, branded a liar on the board.
Could the dishonesty apply to the violence, to violent incidents that were deliberately concealed and remained unacknowledged both inside and outside the family?
Lucius brightened. It'd be all the worse if the image of the family was something very different. Kreitzler smiled with real satisfaction.
Precisely. Then, if we have an outwardly respectable father, who at the very least beats his wife and children.
Lucius's face screwed up a bit. I didn't necessarily mean a father. It could have been anyone in the family. Laszlo waved him off.
The father would be the greatest betrayal.
Sarah tried to read Kreitzler. Not the mother?
Look at it from an empirical standpoint, Sarah. How many households have you known that were ruled by dominating violent mothers?
There is more than one kind of violence, Doctor. But I shall have more to say about that when we reach the end of the letter. Kreitzler had already written violent but outwardly respectable father on the blackboard.
It's evident that feelings, perhaps even delusions of persecution, have taken root in him. I very much doubt that our man is in a deluded state as yet, but his behavior is probably quite antisocial.
Couldn't the murders themselves satisfy the antisocial drive, leaving him the rest of the time outwardly normal and, well, participatory, functional?
Good point, Sarah. Perhaps even overly functional. This will not be a man who, in the opinion of his neighbors, could slaughter children and claim to have eaten them.
Kreitzler jotted these ideas down and then faced us again.
And so, we arrive at the second and even more extraordinary paragraph.
Marcus stepped in. One thing it tells us right away is that he hasn't traveled much abroad. I don't know what he's been reading, but widespread cannibalism hasn't been seen in Europe lately.
But if we accept that his travel has been limited to the United States, what are we to make of your theory that his mountaineering skills indicate a European heritage?
First generation American. The parents were immigrants.
Sarah drew a quick breath.
Dirty immigrants.
Kreitzler's face filled with gratification.
Indeed, the phrase resounds with loathing, doesn't it? It's a kind of hatred that generally has a specific root. In this case, he's probably had a troubled relationship with one or both parents early on, and eventually grew to despise everything about them, including their heritage.
Yet it's his own heritage, too, I observed.
That might account for some of the savagery toward the children. It's self-loathing, as if he's trying to clean the dirt out of himself.
An interesting phrase, John.
Marcus was tapping a pencil into one hand thoughtfully.
Any chance this cannibalism business was a childhood nightmare? He says he's read it. Any chance he read it then, when he was a child? I mean, the effect would have been greater.
Ask yourself a more basic question. What is the strongest force behind imagination?
Sarah had no trouble with that.
Fear.
Yes.
I offer this only as a theory, but suppose the cannibalism story was then what it is now, a tale designed to terrify. Only now, rather than the terrorized party, our man is the terrorizer. As we've constructed him thus far, wouldn't he find that immensely satisfying, even amusing? And who generally terrifies children with stories?
Adults who want them to behave.
Excellent, Moore. My very point.
Lucius looked uncomfortable. But I'm sorry, but I'm afraid I still don't know how to discuss certain things with a lady present.
Sarah was impatient. Then pretend one isn't.
Well, what about the focus on the buttocks?
Ah. I droned on, having thought of something, but like Lucius, unsure of how to phrase it in front of a woman. The references not only to dirt, but to, fecal matter.
Sarah looked at me with disdain.
The word he uses is shit.
Every man in the room, including Kreitzler, seemed to spring a few inches off the floor for a second or two.
Oh, honestly, gentlemen, if I'd known you were all so modest, I'd have stuck to secretarial work.
The room was as quiet as the grave for half a minute, and then Kreitzler continued.
I believe we were discussing the references to shit.
Doctor, have you ever been closely involved with the care of an infant?
Only as a physician, and then rarely.
Why, Sarah?
It's not a time of childhood that men figure greatly in, as a rule. When you find children with an abnormal fixation on defecation, Doctor, what form does it generally take?
Either excessive urge or morbid reluctance, generally.
Urge or reluctance to what?
To go to the toilet.
And how have they learned to go to the toilet?
They have been taught.
By men, generally?
Kreitzler had to pause at that.
The line of questioning had seemed obscure at first, but now we could all see where Sarah was going. If our killer's rather obsessive concern with feces, buttocks, and the more generalized dirt had been implanted in childhood, it was likely that contact with a woman or women, mother, nurse, governess, or what have you, had been involved in the process.
I take it, then, that you have yourself observed this process, Sarah?
Occasionally. And I've heard stories. A girl does. It's always assumed that you'll need the knowledge. The whole affair can be surprisingly difficult, embarrassing, frustrating, sometimes even violent. I wouldn't bring it up, except that the references are so insistent. Sarah went on to say that she believed that only a mother could have had the kind of profound impact that was evident in this case. An abusive governess or female relative might be harrowing for a child, but if that child had recourse to his natural mother for protection and consolation, the effect would have been dramatically reduced. It was apparent to Sarah that the man we were after had never known such recourse, a circumstance that could be explained in a number of ways. But Sarah's preferred theory was that the woman had not wished to bear children in the first place. She'd only done so, Sarah speculated, because she'd either become pregnant or had been offered no other socially acceptable role to play by the particular world in which she lived. The end result of all this was that the woman had deeply resented the children she did bear. One conclusion was becoming increasingly clear. It was unlikely that we were dealing with people who enjoyed the advantages of wealth. In the first place, wealthy parents are seldom obliged to cope with their children if they find them troublesome or undesirable. Then, too, a young woman of means in the 1860s, the period during which we suspected our killer had been born, could have devoted her life to pursuits other than motherhood. Of course, an accidental pregnancy could happen to anyone, rich or poor, but the extreme sexual and scatological fixations displayed by our killer had suggested to Sarah close scrutiny and frequent humiliation, and these in turn spoke of a life lived at very close quarters, the kind of life that poverty breeds. When Sarah finished, Kreitzler offered a very decent salute to her efforts. Then he plowed on.
Next, there is the reference to a red engine. Other than another attempt to make us think him an ignoramus, what do we make of it?
Well, the whole phrase seems important, Lucius offered. Dirtier than a red engine. He was looking for a superlative, and that's what he came up with.
Well, if we assume that the immigrant resentment is a family-based, then he himself isn't an Indian, but he must have had some kind of contact with them.
Why, Marcus? Race hatred doesn't require familiarity.
No, but the two usually do accompany each other. And look at the phrase itself. It's fairly casual, as if he naturally associates filth with Indians and assumes everyone else does, too.
I nodded, seeing his point.
Well, that'd be out west. You don't usually hear that kind of talk in the East. It's not that we're more enlightened by any means, but too few people share the point of reference.
What about it, Marcus? Does the idea of a frontier upbringing appeal?
Marcus thought it over.
Well, it has attractions. First of all, it explains the knife, which is a frontier weapon. It also gives us the hunting, recreational and otherwise, without the need for a wealthy background. And while there's plenty of terrain for mountaineering in the West, it's concentrated in specific areas, which might help. There are whole communities of German and Swiss immigrants out there, too.
Then we shall mark it as a favored possibility. That takes us to the next paragraph, at which point our man finally gets down to specifics. On February 18th, he spots the Santorelli boy. Having spent more time than I'd care to admit going over calendars and almanacs, I can tell you that February 18th was Ash Wednesday this year.
Laszlo's recent investigation of the timings of the murders had led him to believe that they could be tied to the Christian calendar.
It could be that his personal conflicts are playing out according to a schedule that happens to be natural, even convenient, for him.
Next, the use of the word parading suggests many things.
Parading.
Moore, I recall your thought some weeks ago that the man suffers from a disability or a deformity of some kind which explains his violence to the eyes of his victims. There's a trace of envy in the word parading, as if he himself is excluded from such behavior.
Although several weeks earlier I had been the first to advance such a theory, I now warned him to be very careful about accepting it. We already knew that the man we were pursuing could get up and down the sides of buildings by way of a simple rope while carrying an adolescent boy. He had to be big and tall, probably over 6 feet. If he was deformed, it could not be in his